called Help Me Be Good. And it was aimed at teaching children some of the basics of being able to get along with other people, including a book called A Children's Book on Whining. Why are you laughing? You're laughing because if you're like me, nothing but nothing raises your blood pressure like hearing whining. And sometimes, you know, if a child's really persistent at it, they'll throw in a little bit of dancing and foot stomping and some other things along with that whining, and it tries your patience as a parent and as an adult. And it gets worse the older a child is that's doing the whining, the more repulsive it gets. In this book, A Children's Book on Whining, author Joy Berry describes whining as crying or talking in a complaining, nagging way. The American Heritage Dictionary defines it, in contrast to constructive criticism, to complain or protest in a childish, annoying fashion. Well, what I want us to think about today is simply the fact that just as whining in children doesn't go over very well with us, whining in adults does not go over well with God. In Philippians chapter 2 and verse 14, Paul writes, "Do all things without grumbling or disputing." Whining may be generally a childish trait. It is something that we work hard to remove from our children's behavior as early as possible. But while it's a childish trait, unfortunately, children aren't the only ones who do it. I want you to be turning to the Old Testament, the book of Exodus. I'm going to let you do that while I come down here and grab the clicker that I forgot to pick up. Because I want you to see some examples of whining in Old Testament Israel's history. Complaining about their situation. Complaining no matter what their situation seems to have been. And so here's some things we find. We find Israel whining, for example, even when they were still in Egypt. Well, I guess that may be a little bit understandable given the condition of slavery to the state in which they lived. But in this particular incident, it's Exodus chapter 5 and verse 20, when Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh for the first time and made the initial demands from God about releasing the people. When they left Pharaoh's presence, the sons of Israel had been told by the foreman, the Egyptians, "We're going to make your life harder." And so when they left Pharaoh's presence, these elders of Israel met with Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them, and they said, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of his servants, to put a sword in their hand to kill us." That's the sort of gratitude that Moses and Aaron received as they began the work of persuading Pharaoh to let the people of Israel go from their slavery in Egypt. Initially, the people of Israel complained about it. But they're not done complaining. When we turn over to Exodus chapter 14, as they are on the shores of the Red Sea, chapter 14 and verse 10, God has already enabled them to leave Egypt. But now, verse 10 of chapter 14 says, "As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord. Then they said to Moses, 'Is it because there were no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, "Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians"? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." Now, as they say those things, you may recall that when God first spoke to Moses about becoming the deliverer for the people of Israel, He said that their cry had reached His ears, that the affliction of His people Israel has caught His attention. But now here are these same people saying, no, we weren't afflicted at all. It was way better back in Egypt. We want to go back there. Chapter 16 of Exodus. Not long after they leave Egypt, in verse 1, Then they set out from Elim, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after their departure from the land of Egypt. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to them, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So they complained because they had no food. God provided food. And in verse 12, God said, "I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, 'At twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God.'" But unfortunately, there's more complaining to read about. Turn over to the book of Numbers for a couple of examples. Chapter 14 of the book of Numbers. Numbers 14, starting in verse 1. "Then all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. All the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said, 'Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died into the wilderness.'" This is after the 12 spies were sent into the land of Canaan. They are at the borders of Canaan, ready to go in and possess it, and these spies have come back with a report, not only about how beautiful the land is, but about how powerful its people are and how strong and well fortified its cities are. And most of those spies have said, "It's hopeless. We cannot take the land." That prompts the complaint that we read here. Verse 3, "Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt." God has brought them all the way from Egypt, across the Red Sea, through the wilderness, to Mount Sinai, established His covenant with them, and now brought them to the borders of Canaan, and they're saying, "It's no use, let's just go back." But they're not done. Chapter 20 of Numbers. During what we call the wilderness wandering period, the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness that was Israel's punishment for that complaining that we just read about in Numbers chapter 14, Chapter 20 and verse 1, "Then the sons of Israel, the whole congregation, came to the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed at Kadesh. Now Miriam died there and was buried there. There was no water for the congregation, and they assembled themselves against Moses and Aaron, and the people thus contended with Moses and spoke, saying, 'If only we had perished when our brothers perished before the Lord. Why then have you brought the Lord's assembly into this wilderness for us and our beasts to die here? Why have you made us come up from Egypt to bring us into this wretched place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there water to drink.'" Chapter 21, verse 4. "Then they set out from Mount Hor by way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the people became impatient because of the journey. The people spoke against God and Moses, 'Why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this miserable food.'" They're talking about the food, by the way, that God was miraculously providing for them every single day. It gets irritating just reading those accounts, one after another of the Israelites. "Moses, why did you bring us out here? Why didn't you just let us die in Egypt?" How did God feel about all that? We don't have to wonder. I want you to read Paul's analysis of it in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Because Paul writes about Israel's mistakes in the wilderness as a warning to us. 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Beginning in verse 1, he says, "I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea and all drank, ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. Nevertheless, with most of them God was not well pleased, for they were laid low in the wilderness. Now these things happened as examples for us, so that we would not crave evil things as they also craved. Do not be idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, 'The people sat down to eat and drink and stood up to play.' Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some did and were destroyed by serpents. And then look at verse 10. Nor grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. Paul says, now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction upon whom the ends of the ages have come. God was not pleased with all of Israel's whining. And neither is He when we do it. Again, we are not talking about constructive criticism that seeks to make things better. What we're really talking about in a lot of these instances is the kind of whining and complaining that masks a desire for inaction, that tries to offer an excuse for a terrible attitude or an inactive approach. Sometimes Christians whine. That's why Paul writes in Philippians 2 and verse 14, do all things without grumbling or disputing. Not sincere expressions of dissatisfaction or concern, but like those that are described in another New Testament epistle, Jude's little letter in verse 16. He says, these are grumblers, finding fault, following after their own desires. Why? Why do we whine? What are some of the reasons behind our complaining and grumbling? That's what I want us to think about in the time that we have left this morning. Just a handful of ideas. Why do we whine? Well, one reason is what I would call idealism. And by that I simply mean that we have a picture in our heads of what perfect is, and anything short of that, we complain about. And so it is often said that the perfect is the enemy of the good. Because so often, whether we're talking about our individual daily pursuits, our business pursuits, whatever it might be, and yes, our spiritual pursuits as well, we have a vision of a perfect set of circumstances, and anything that doesn't measure up to that perfection, we just say, what's the use? Look how terrible this is. And we complain. One of the ways that shows itself is in an unrealistic longing for an imagined perfect past. Sometimes we dream of better past days, and we compare that to the way things are now, and we think, oh my goodness, look how much better things used to be. Was that not Israel's problem? At least in their heads, as they were out there in the wilderness, they had this image of Egypt as this place where they had plenty to eat, and everything was comfortable, and everything was provided for them, seemingly forgetting about all that stuff about their, you know, being enslaved to the Pharaoh and all the hard work they had to do. And that happens to us. We envision past circumstances as much better than they actually were, and the present as much worse than it actually is. And we use that very often as an excuse for inaction, an excuse for not working to make the most of the opportunities that we have. Sometimes you'll hear Christians say things like, you know, people just don't come to gospel meetings like they used to. Why even have them? Folks just aren't hospitable to one another the way they were when I was a kid. And even in a single congregation, I think especially it can be this way if it's a congregation of which we have been a part for a very long time. It's easy to envision a past, you know, things just aren't the way they used to be. Things have really changed. You know what? Things just change. Circumstances change. Congregations, hopefully, grow. And the makeup of those congregations just naturally changes over time. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7, there's a warning from Solomon. Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 10 says this. Ecclesiastes 7 verse 10 says, do not say, why were the former days better than these? For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. Ouch. There's Solomon reminding me, don't be living in the past and reconstructing it in your head as something better than it actually was. We do that in all kinds of ways. We do that in, you know, people do that in economic discussions. You know, we talk about how much more plentiful and much better jobs were in the 1950s, for example. Okay? You can have a very good 1950s standard of living on the cheap right now. But see, that's not what we want, is it? But I'm not talking about economics this morning. I'm talking about spiritual things. And we do the same thing. Another way that this idealism can get in our way is when we wait for perfect circumstances to act. Another warning from Ecclesiastes. This one's in chapter 11. Ecclesiastes 11 and verse 4. Solomon says, "He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap." Many of you have experience in agriculture. Solomon pictures the farmer who walks out of the house and looks up at the sky and says, "Nope, not today." And the next day he walks out of the house and looks up at the sky and says, "Nope, conditions just aren't right, not today." And never, ever gets around to planting or reaping because he's always waiting on conditions to be perfect. Do we do that spiritually? I can tell you from experience, we do that when it comes to sharing the gospel. We're always looking for a perfect set of circumstances in which to talk to somebody about Jesus. That usually involves imagining a person in a particular set of circumstances with a particular attitude. And I've got to tell you, that perfect situation, it doesn't happen. I have been surprised in my lifetime at how very often opportunities arise that I never expected. They weren't perfect. Maybe you've had that experience too. When that happens, you've got two choices. You can either say, this looks really good, but I just wish it was this. I wish this person had this background or this understanding or could meet at a more convenient time. So I'm sorry. I can't do the teaching. Or you can say, as we do with countless other things in life, this may not be perfect, but it's an opportunity, and I'm going to make the most of it. Which attitude proves more rewarding? Sometimes we let idealism cause us to whine. Sometimes it's just pessimism. We just see a situation as hopeless. There are always some people in any environment, your business, your sports team, your local church, who will say, "Nah, it'll never work. No matter what you bring up, it'll never work. I don't like that. It won't work." In 1 Corinthians chapter 16 and verse 9, as Paul brings that letter to a close, he starts to think a little bit about some of his future plans. And he says this, 1 Corinthians chapter 16. In verse 7, he mentions his hope eventually to come to Corinth for some time, if God permits. But he says, verse 8, "I will remain in Ephesus until Pentecost, for a wide door for effective service has been opened to me, and there are many adversaries." It would be very easy for anybody to look at that, take the thoughts of verse 9, and just focus on one thing, the many adversaries. It would be easy for somebody in Paul's situation to say, "Here I am in Ephesus. Boy, there's a lot of opposition. You know what? I'm out of here. Can I come see you guys in Corinth? This is terrible. This will never work." When we read the book of Acts, we found out that Paul got a lot done in Ephesus. Luke writes that the whole province of Asia heard the word of the Lord as a result of what Paul was doing in Ephesus. Yes, there was lots of opposition, but Paul saw first the opportunities that that presented, the opportunities even that the opposition created for him. What a different outlook than the one that I am sometimes tempted to have. So in 2 Corinthians 3 and verse 5, Paul writes, "Not that we are sufficient of ourselves to think of anything as being from ourselves. Our sufficiency," he wrote, "is from God." You see, that's what makes the difference. That's what makes the difference between an optimistic outlook and a pessimistic one in so many areas of life, and particularly for the child of God, when we consider the opportunities that are open to us each and every day. Not just the opportunity to share the gospel, although that's certainly an important one. Every day you get up, you've got opportunities to let your light shine, as Jesus commands us in Matthew 5, to show others Christ living in you, to let them see in the decisions you make, the way you talk, the way you act, the way you dress, and numerous other things. This is what a life dedicated to Christ looks like. This is what Jesus can do with a life. You have opportunities to fulfill God's commandments in your workplace, in your family life, even in your recreation. You have an opportunity to demonstrate what commitment to God does in a person's life. Every waking moment of every day, there are a lot of things that are going to try to get in the way of that. There are people who are going to try to get in the way of that. Are you just going to complain about the obstacles and use that as an excuse not to give the Lord your best? Or are you going to see the obstacles as just further opportunities? Yes, difficulties. There's nothing wrong with acknowledging real difficulties. But will I let pessimism just cause me to whine all the time and more or less give up? Fear. Sometimes we find fault with the things that we are afraid to try. That was the problem with those 10 out of the 12 spies who were sent to scout out the land of Canaan. They came back with a report that said, oh, it's a beautiful land, flowing with milk and honey and all that stuff, but the people are huge. And the cities, the walls are so big that and they have such powerful weapons. We can't defeat these people. Two of the spies had a different take. They saw the same things that the other 10 did. They saw how big the people were and how strong the cities were and how powerful the weapons were. They saw all the same things that the other 10 did. But Joshua and Caleb said, God will surely bring us into the land. Now, why did they say that? Because God had promised to bring them into the land. The thing ultimately that made the difference between Joshua and Caleb and the other 10 spies was fear. Fear and faithlessness. God spoke to Joshua, the leader of the people, as they prepared to conquer the land of Canaan. Here we are now years later, and that spy Joshua has been elevated to the position of leadership in Israel. And God in Joshua 1 and verse 9 spoke to him and said, have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid. Do not be dismayed. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. God knew that fear could cause pessimism. It could cause whining. It could cause complaining and inaction. And so he encouraged Joshua not to be afraid, but to lean on God. We have a very similar set of instructions in Romans chapter 8. Paul says in Romans 8 and verse 31, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? That's the New Testament version of be strong and courageous. If God is for us, who can be against us? With that mindset, we will not be fearful and complaining all the time. Sometimes we complain because of laziness. We find fault with what we are just too lazy to be bothered with. Proverbs 22, verse 13, in the characteristic language of the Proverbs, the pictures that it draws, addresses this. Proverbs 22, verse 13, the slothful man says, there is a lion outside. I shall be slain in the streets. As his excuse not to get up and go to work, be productive. So Paul encourages us, 1 Corinthians chapter 15, therefore, my brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Again, you've experienced it on the job. You've experienced it in other environments. People will complain about things that they ultimately are just too lazy to give their attention and their energy to. Complaining, they think, will just deflect other people's interest in it and relieve them of the responsibility of the work. Sometimes we complain because of selfishness. That is especially evident in the complaining we may do about other people. Mark chapter 7 says that when some of the Pharisees, the rulers of the Jews, saw Jesus' disciples eat bread with unwashed hands, they found fault with them, Mark 7 and verse 2. Your disciples don't follow the traditions of the elders, they said. And that led to an interesting conversation. Selfishness, a desire for power and influence, very often motivated such men to criticize Jesus and his disciples simply because they did things not exactly the same way that others did. Sometimes we focus on the faults of others while ignoring our own. Jesus went on to confront those Jewish leaders about some of the traditions they had come up with that had them at fault because they were essentially providing people with what they thought was an easy way to avoid fulfilling basic commandments of God. It's easy to see the faults in others and ignore mine. It's easy to complain about the faults of others while ignoring mine. Sometimes we complain out of envy. In Philippians chapter 2, where we began earlier this morning, Paul in verse 3 says, "Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem others better than himself." Sometimes our complaining is from ingratitude. We are not possessed of a thankful spirit, so instead we complain. Did you not see that in the complaining of Israel, the whining of Israel that we read about earlier in the lesson? God brought them out of Egypt and they complained. They complained because they had no water. God gave them water. They complained because they had no food. God gave them food. Then they complained because they were tired of the food that God had given them. And on the problems went. Ingratitude after ingratitude manifested itself in their constant whining no matter what God did for them. Some people are just never content, never thankful. I am reminded of that when I complain and am made to stop and think of all the things I ought to be expressing gratitude for instead of dissatisfaction. Paul wrote in Colossians chapter 4 and verse 2, "Continue earnestly in prayer, being vigilant in it with thanksgiving." The Bible gives us multiple other commands about being thankful. If I have a proper attitude of gratitude for what others have done for me, and particularly the way God has blessed me, it makes it a lot harder to whine. As we said, all of these things overlap to some extent. They all are reflected when I complain, when I grumble, and when I use that whining and complaining as a mask for my own inaction, as an excuse for a poor attitude and a poor approach. None of this is to say that when problems arise, we shouldn't be able to talk about them, to confront them, but we need to be confronting them with a view toward solving the problems. When spiritual problems arise, we need to be confronting them with a view toward growing closer to God and not just complaining about things that aren't the way we would like them to be. Do all things, Paul wrote, without grumbling or disputing. There may be a free translation out there somewhere that has the word whining in that verse. For most of us, it would be a pretty apt way to understand what Paul's getting at. What have you whined about this week? I am guilty. As I thought about these things, I realized how often I am guilty. Sometimes not publicly, but often in private. What about you? What things are you going to work hard to change this week instead of complaining about? If you would turn to the number that Barry announces our invitation song for this morning, number 842. I want to go back to one of those first points that I made for a minute. How sometimes our complaining is a result of a desire for the perfect. Because sometimes I wonder if that's not going on in the minds of some folks as they contemplate obeying the gospel. They know, deep down, they know that they need to respond to the offer of Jesus Christ in faith, in repentance, and in obedient baptism. They know, but they want to make excuses for why they haven't done it. And sometimes it comes down to, I'm waiting for exactly the perfect set of circumstances. I actually had one young lady years ago tell me that she knew she really needed to obey the gospel. She was just waiting for a particular invitation song to be sung, but she wouldn't tell you which one it was. I knew she was just blowing smoke, making excuses for something else. I don't know what was holding her back. But that's what we do, is it not? If that's what you're doing, may I just suggest there's not going to be a perfect set of circumstances that's better than right now to render obedience to the gospel. Because here's the thing, God is not waiting on you to be perfect. He's not waiting on your circumstances to be perfect. He wants to save you from your own imperfection. Will you let Him do that? Do you realize how deeply you need a Savior this morning? Realize that forgiveness and fellowship with God is only found at the foot of the cross. Then what are you waiting for? There's no time like the present.